Hey guys, welcome to Tales from a Butterfly podcast. I'm your host, Taria Shondell. Sometimes caterpillar, sometimes butterfly, but always striving to make it through life's many metamorphoses with my faith intact. With this podcast, I hope to encourage anyone that is going through life situations, no matter what they are, that have left you feeling like you will forever be a caterpillar in the cocooning stage, having to continually shed your skin while fighting to get free from any chains that are holding you back from your transformation. I want to tell you, keep your faith in the transformer, believing that just like the butterfly, when you come out, you will be a thing of beauty who is not afraid to fly. So come on, my butterflies, let's fly. You're listening to episode 45 of the Tales from a Butterfly podcast, titled Empowering Episodes from Empowered People, Part 1. And I'm your host, Taria Shondell. So let's get into it. Hey guys, thanks for coming back this week and tuning in. So with 2018 on the horizon, 2 days away, because I'm recording this on a Saturday, I wanted to go back through some of my beginning episodes that were so encouraging, so inspiring. Well, actually, I feel that all of them, especially every single guest I've had on this podcast, blessed me and you listeners, you know, with their transparency and their stories of how they made it through from their caterpillar to their butterfly moment, you know, their metamorphosis. And some of them are on a continued metamorphosis journey, which is beautiful to see. And again, that they shared that with us. So I decided to start a series called Empowering Episodes from Empowered People. And again, this is part one. And I'm going to randomly post part two, part three, part four. Today, the series is going to be on, again, encouraging and empowerment people. My next series will be on marriage, you know, couples speaking about empowering marriages, past couples that I've had. These episodes will all be pulled from past episodes that I've had. I'll have people speaking on finances, you know, people speaking on motherhood, again, all from past episodes. So when you hear the snippets of the episodes that you're about to hear, you can always go back and listen to the full episodes. So my very first podcast was titled, Well, Hello There, Butterfly, Letter to My Future Self. And in that episode, I talked about writing a letter to the future you. And, you know, I know traditionally, we want to talk to our younger selves. But the reality is that although the experiences and the interactions that I had when I was the younger Taria played a major role in my future and who I would become, you know, I finally understood that although I appreciated what the younger Taria had taught me and showed me about myself, both the good and the bad and the ugly, today, when I had written that letter, but I'm saying today, I had to understand that, again, although she helped me get to where I needed to be and taught me things about myself, we had to part ways. I couldn't continue to carry the past Taria on forever as an excuse for actions, as an excuse for non-action. You know, because sometimes we'll use what happened to us in our past as an excuse to why we can't move forward in our present. So I had to understand that it was time for her and I to part ways and that I had to embrace the future Taria so that I could be my best self for me and for others in my life who may be looking to me for guidance, my children, you know. So I had to embrace the future Taria to be the best me that I could be. So take a listen to part one of the letter that I wrote to myself. I am so proud of you for becoming the person, the woman who you were looking for becoming the person you needed in your life, knowing that one day someone will need a you and you'll be ready, for understanding that the words you spoke would either be the breath of life that sustained you to the future you or cause you to choke and your dreams to die by asphyxiation, never moving beyond the past you. I am proud of the woman you have become, a woman who knows her worth is far above rubies and doesn't allow anyone or anything to make her feel less than, a woman who chooses to recognize her strength as a mother, while knowing God's power is made perfect in her weakness. I'm proud of you, Taria, for recognizing what you bring to the table of friendship. And although not perfect, you sit in love. And at the same time, you are willing to lay down your fork, turn your plate down, and walk away in grace when what is being served has been contaminated, whether by another table guest or by you yourself. I'm proud of you for no longer defending yourself or apologizing for the type of friend you are, for understanding that although you may have experienced hurt at the hand of a friend, you've probably caused that same hurt in someone else and have chosen to forgive yourself and to continue to strive to be a better person, not for people, but for God and for yourself. I am proud of you for acknowledging that while the sum total of your past experiences adds up to the person you used to be, on this forward-moving journey of your life, you understand the price of taking extra bags will cost your future too much. So you decided to exercise your right to hand over all your past baggage to a God whose yoke is easy and whose burden is light. And although you appreciate and recognize the important life lessons that you learned from a past Taria, you made the decision that she could no longer dictate your future to you. So I celebrate this Taria today and the way you have chosen to submit your heart fully and completely to God, choosing to follow him at all costs and allowing him to define who you are. I bid adieu to the caterpillar of the past who had to fight to survive the process of metamorphosis. And I say hello to the beautiful butterfly that has come forth as strong, powerful, bold, and free. Well, hello there, Taria Shondell, and welcome to your future. Love, Taria. There are going to be times when it seems like you're in the fight of your life. Like all of your hopes and your dreams, those same dreams you promised yourself that you would one day realize, they seem like they're the ones that are going to take you out. And I just want to give you a little piece of advice and some encouragement. When this happens, because it will happen, there will be times when you feel like your dreams are overtaking you and the fact that it just seems like you can't quite get to them. I want you to think about the lesson that I learned in episode 4 titled, I'm not a boxer, but I can fight. I learned that you can make history, y'all. You just gotta keep moving. You can't stay stagnant. You gotta keep moving. So as it relates to Cassius Clay, on February 24th, Cassius Clay, weighing in at 210 pounds, walked into a room full of sports writers that already had their pins on his opponent, Sonny Liston, winning. So all of them predicted against him and predicted that Sonny Liston was winning. There was no way this 22-year-old was going to come and beat Sonny Liston. So Cassius didn't believe that about himself. He felt like he was going to win, but he spent so much energy shouting how great he was and trying to taunt his enemy, Sonny Liston, that he ended up being fined $2,500 by the commission. And this fight, the fight that would cement him as the greatest fighter in history, almost didn't happen, because not only did he get fined due to his taunting and his yelling and his jumping back and forth and all this, his heart rate elevated and his blood pressure rose. So the doctors told him if he did not calm down and his blood pressure get back to normal, there would be no fight. So I believe it was twice that they checked his blood pressure. I believe. You can always look that up, but I believe it was twice. So, of course, we all know that his blood pressure did get back down to normal and the fight went on. And what was interesting to me was he said in the 4th round, his eyes started burning. They started burning to the point where he started to make kind of like a fuss, like a ruckus. Like even the referees noticed, like, what's going on? Is there a problem here? So his trainer, Angelo Dundee, tried to calm him down. And was like, you know, calm down, calm down. And he's like, man, I can just imagine, man, my eyes, y'all, my eyes are burning. You know, I can just imagine with his pretty voice, smooth, pretty voice, him saying that. And so his trainer said, you know, again, he made such a ruckus before he went and got a sponge and some water to pour in his eyes. But before he did that, the trainer took his pinky, touched Cassius Clay's eyes and then touched his own eyes. And he said his own eyes started to burn. And they knew then that there was something caustic in his eyes. And when I was doing my research, there were other fighters that had fought Sonny Liston who said they experienced the same thing. It was shortly around round four when their eyes started burning to the point that they couldn't see him. So they had no chance of beating him because they couldn't see where he was. Their eyes were burning. So they almost felt like it was a conspiracy. But there was something different about Cassius because he knew who he was. So he said, even though it burned and he could barely see, what he could see was a faint shadow of Liston during most of the round. So what he saw was a faint shadow of his enemy. And since he was able to see that shadow, and since he was already trained cardiovascularly to be able to be in a ring for long periods of time without getting winded, he said the only way he managed to survive was to circle and move around. He had to keep dancing around, keep moving, and stay away from that shadow of the enemy that he saw. So he didn't, he may have gotten tired, but then his reserve kicked in, you know, because your body is like a bank. What you put into it is what you get out of it. So if you go to the bank and you put in $1,000 and then 3 days from now, an emergency situation happens and you need $1,050, well, you can't get $1,050 because you only put in $1,000. Same thing with your body. You know, what you put into it is what you get out of it. So Cassius Clay was putting in the training, the running, jumping rope, weightlifting. And when this emergency situation came and he couldn't see, so he had to depend on another source, which was his energy, being able to move around to avoid the enemy, he was able to do it because he had trained for it. So again, he couldn't see him. He only saw a faint shadow, but he managed to survive by circling and moving. But he said by the sixth round, he had regained his eyesight. So it didn't last the whole time. He was able to fight through and press through two rounds of where he couldn't even see the man. But by the sixth round, he had regained his sight and went on to win the fight. You know, and he defied all the odds and all the predictions that were against him. And he showed them that the impossible could be done. That old Sonny Liston, well, the sun had been eclipsed. And at that point, the win wasn't just for him. What he did, him winning, wasn't just for him. It was for others too, I believe, because other boxers, seeing that Sonny Liston could be defeated, that then gave them hope. Seeing that the enemy could be defeated gave them hope that they too could defeat the enemy. They just needed to make sure they went through the proper training. And, you know, one could say in that moment with that fight, he became a legend. You know, he was the champion. Now, again, like I said in the beginning, I'm not a boxer, but I am a fighter. And I know that for me, especially when I had lost my job and then it was just one thing after the other, just felt like it was compounded. I felt like life was so much bigger than me and stronger than me. And that life was just knocking me down. And before I was able to get back up, but I almost felt like I didn't know if I'd be able, you know, to get back up. You know, all my life, even as a little girl, I remember feeling like I was going to be something. Just feeling like I was created to be something. I didn't know what it was, but I honestly felt like I just knew God had something for me. And it involved helping other people. At one point, I thought I was going to travel the world helping people. I wanted to be a lawyer. So I thought, I'm going to be a lawyer, traveling the world, helping people. And I remember saying to God in my bedroom, and I was in elementary school, well, God, you're going to have to provide my salary because they're not going to be able to pay it, because I wanted to help the people that couldn't afford to get good legal representation. And I said, Lord, you're just going to have to figure out a way to pay me, but I want to be a lawyer. That didn't end up happening, but I knew that I was going to be something. But again, you know, as the years go on and as your rose-colored kid glasses come off and real life, you know, gets clearer in your vision, you're like, man, maybe all those things I felt as a child were just that, childlike feelings. Maybe it's kind of over for me, you know, and that's what I felt like. I felt like life had, I mean, literally knocked me down before I could reach my dreams. And I remember I'd get up in the morning, Corey would go off to work, the kids would go off to school and I would just be crying by myself in here, not saying anything, but just crying because I didn't want anybody to know how deep that cut was for me. How much of a state I was in. I felt raw. And, you know, I almost felt like somebody had unzipped my body and flipped it inside out and everything was exposed for everybody to see, that they'd be able to see my pain and see that I was feeling like I was pretty much worthless in a certain sense, because again, I had made my job my identity and now I'm home. And see, I was one who said I would never be a stay-at-home mom. I remember, y'all, it was my freshman year college. Shout out to Penn State McKeesport. And I was in the dorms and I believe I was with two other girls and three guys, and we were having like a little roundtable discussion. And one of the guys, you know, very traditional, he was raised where his dad provided, his mom stayed home. And, you know, now he was in college and he said, you know, I believe that my wife is going to stay home. She's not going to work when we have kids. And I remember my 18-year-old self being so sure of that I was going to be something. I said to him, I would never stay home and waste my degree. Why would I get a degree just to stay home? I'm going to work. I remember saying that. And now here I am, a stay-at-home mom. So be careful what you say, because God will be like, oh, really? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and turn your world upside down, because that's what he did for me. But I realized it wasn't a waste. I'm just now I'm actually not even a stay-at-home. I'm a domestic engineer. I engineer everything that goes on in his home, from lunch money to the budget to where we're going on vacation to all different types of things. So I like to think of myself as a domestic engineer. But I digress. So like I was saying, those days when everybody was out of the house and I'm in the house just crying, it was almost like I could hear God whisper, remember who you are. And not only who you are, remember whose you are. So I started remembering, who am I? Who am I? I know who I am and I know whose I am. And I remember who trained me and who was my corner man. My corner man was the very one who breathed life into me, the life that I was still living. Because even though life had knocked me down, it didn't kill me. I was living. So I had to remember that I had to keep fighting everything that I know God promised me and my family, and not just my family in my house, my family outside of my house, aunts, uncles, parents, brothers, sisters. I had to fight for everything that God promised me and my family. So on those days when I was here by myself, and it just seemed like it was bad news after bad news, letters coming in the mail, you know, unemployment denied. Now you have to go to a hearing and this happened and this is due and that's due. And when life felt so heavy and my tears of frustration, anger, depression, sadness burned my eyes and blurred my vision, I remembered, Taria, you gotta keep moving. And then now as I'm realizing those moments now, I'm thinking about how back then before I lost my job and how I had, you know, did all this research on Muhammad Ali and his quotes. It's funny because just like he said, the only way he managed to survive and not be knocked down and counted out was because he kept moving. I realized I had to keep moving because I couldn't allow the enemy to take my vision, or that would have been it for me, because the Bible says you perish without vision. Those who have a lack of vision, you perish. So even though I was crying, even though, like I said, my tears were burning my eyes and I'm like, God, are you serious? I don't know if I could take much more, but I knew one thing. I knew I had to keep moving so that I could survive, so that I could make it. Now I'm so, so, so thankful to Cassius Clay, AKA Muhammad Ali, for teaching me, a girl who knows nothing about boxing, but he taught me that I could fight. I could fight whatever is trying to come at me. I could fight the failures that are trying to come at me. I could fight the insecurities that are trying to come at me. I can fight the doubt and the fear that's trying to come at me. All I had to do was keep moving. Keep moving. Keep moving. That's the message. Keep moving. And even when you can't necessarily see that it's right in front of you, but you know it's coming at you, keep moving. And I did. I decided I was going to keep moving, even during the times when I had to look around and wonder where God was in everything that was going on. You know, where was he in these different situations that I felt like were trying to take me under, these situations that I had to continuously fight? Here's a snippet from episode 6, when I had to stop and ask God, "Are you there, God? It's me, Taria." Let me guess. I know you've been there too, right? Listen up. Seemed like it made sense or seemed really fair. So I'm like, okay, God, well, I have some questions for you. So, and it's not that I question if there is a God or my belief in God. I definitely believe that he's real. I've had my own experiences with God, not experiences based off of my grandmother, my mother, my father. I've had my own experiences. But you know, sometimes in those midnight hours, just before the night sky allows the sun to peek through, you know, the sky with the light of hope for another day, I start asking questions. I normally get up between 4 and 4:30 every morning, and I feel like it's just me and God up. Like, so he can solely focus on me, nobody else. I have his attentions. So it's during those times that I decide, you know what? I talk to him. This particular day, it wasn't 4:30 in the morning, but it was just me and my home. And I figured, well, you know what? Now's an opportune time, you know, to ask him the questions that I had. Questions that if he didn't answer, I knew I wasn't going to get an answer to. At the time that I wrote this, you know, I was 39 years old, 1 month and 23 days, which equaled 312 days away from being 40. Now I believe I'm 100 days out from being 40. You know, and I was feeling like I was stuck. You know, so I was asking God, like, for real, am I still in a caterpillar cocoon that's seemingly steeped in ashes? You know, I feel like I keep having to fight through this transformation to finally possess the beauty of that butterfly. You know, I feel like I've had to go through many metamorphoses, like, oh, okay, God, I just went through one. Now I got to go back in a cocoon, fight through that, you know, and come out of it again. So I started thinking about, you know, different things throughout life. Like I said, you start thinking over your life. And I remember asking God if I was feeling that way because of poor choices and bad decisions that I may have made earlier in my life. And because of those poor choices and bad decisions, was I now just going to exist? You know what I mean? Not live. Like, was I now just going to exist? And if I was just going to exist, what meaning of the word exist was I going to be relegated to? Because Merriam-Webster, one of the ways it defines the word exist is to have being in a specified place or with respect to understand limitations or conditions. I'm going to say that again. Merriam-Webster, one of the ways they define the word exist is to have being in a specified place or with respect to understand limitations or conditions. So my thought was, Lord, okay, I made all these decisions in the past that may not, you know, have glorified you, that were in poor judgment. And even though you're allowing me to exist, are you only going to allow me to exist, you know, under certain limitations and conditions so that I won't be able to move any further? And that would be my fault, you know, because they were my decisions. But, you know, are you now placing certain restrictions on me that won't allow me to move because of these decisions I made? You know, are the consequences from my previous actions, you know, have they become a match that lit all my hopes, my dreams, and my passions and any future progress on fire, causing them to straight up burn out, you know, and sometimes leaving me feeling like everything was destroyed, you know, any chance of pursuing any dreams that I had, you know, was destroyed. And all I had left was the powdery residue that remains after something is destroyed, the ashes. Because, you know, sometimes we feel like because of choices we made, we'll never be able to really get it together, like really the way we dreamed of. We'll never be able to really get it together and move forward. and do what we really want to do in our life. You know, I know for me, like I said, I felt that way. I felt like I was never going to really be able to live in the plan that God had for my life. So, Lord, I'm like, am I stuck living in these ashes? You know, and then as you're having a conversation is two people speaking. So I'm spouting out my questions and then I'm trying to restrain myself. Be quiet, Taria. See if you hear anything from him. Because, you know, sometimes we have a tendency to just kind of word vomit everything that we have. God, you know, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of this. I feel this way. And then we move on throughout our day, never really sitting still and listening. And I know for me, I always like to keep moving, always like to keep being busy, because I know at a certain time, from me getting up at 4:30 in the morning, I'm probably going to crash. So I try to move and do as much as I can when I can. So I have a hard time just sitting still. But I knew this day, for some reason, I just needed to sit still. So after I asked God, you know, am I just stuck living in the ashes of my past? I remembered that he answered that question long before my actual existence on earth. I mean, even long before he had formed me in my mother's womb, before I could even ask him, you know, he had Isaiah tell me the answer to this question. See, part of Isaiah 61 verse 3 in the King James Version says that you would give me beauty for ashes. So it didn't matter if I unknowingly, or let's be honest, knowingly, because sometimes we do things that we know will be detrimental to our future, but we just want to live in that moment, or things and decisions look good and feel good for that moment, but we know it's detrimental. So again, you know, even though I may have unknowingly or knowingly made decisions that I knew weren't pleasing to him, it didn't matter. It didn't matter if I let my self-destructing behavior just straight up set ablaze any particular plans that God had for me, because he could still take the residue of those bad decisions, those ashes, and make them beautiful and make them work in my favor. And I know this because Romans 8 verse 28, the King James Version, specifically tells me, it says, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. So he could take my ashes, make them beauty, and then make them work together for my good. So then I was like, well, okay, God, since you have all the answers and you're all knowing, and I know you've now given me beauty for ashes, that's great. Beauty is wonderful to look at. But should I be further ahead in life? So you're not going to hold my past mistakes against me and make me live in the past. But shouldn't I be further ahead? I mean, if, you know, I'm like, okay, God, if you're going to give me beauty for my past ashes, I should probably still be a little bit further in life now. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever felt this way, but quite honestly, for a while, I had been feeling like my life and my progression was stuck, like sort of like a time zone. It was stuck in a specific time zone. Like, for instance, I was born in Vineland, New Jersey. So I was born in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. But yet, as of late, I had been feeling like life had kept me in the Pacific Standard Time Zone, 3 hours behind what I was supposed to be doing. So I felt like I was continuously behind the eight ball, behind everything I was supposed to be doing, stuck in that Pacific Standard Time Zone. You know, I was continuously running on a treadmill of time that was shaky and not always sturdy, quite frankly. You know, sometimes you feel like your purpose is right there. It's just right there within your reach. You just need to get to it, you know? So I had been feeling like I had been constantly trying to grab it, trying to reach it. Even though it moved a little bit ahead of me, I'm like, if I just run a little faster, I'll be able to get to it. And there were times when I felt like it was actually right in front of me. I could see it. And quite honestly, others could see it and say, Taria, there it is. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You just got to grab it. But I was on that treadmill, you know, that treadmill we call life, running, I'm moving, exhausting energy. Because, you know, running on a treadmill, when you're working out, you know, you're running, keep running. So that means you're putting out energy. You're probably sweating. And sometimes you even make it harder for yourself by purposely putting it on the incline or on a hill. So sometimes in life, we make it purposely harder for ourselves by going up a different path that's harder to walk up, or putting a hill, you know, in our own way. So here I am running on this treadmill of life, you know, putting it on the incline, maybe sometimes throwing in a hill here and there. And I'm just running in place. So yeah, I'm running, but I'm running in place. I'm not making any solid moves forward at all. I'm not taking any strides or any steps forward. So, and then I started hitting the speed button. You know how it has the little arrow on a treadmill? So if you want to go faster, you just hit that button. So here I am thinking, you know what, if I just run a little faster on this treadmill of life, if I run a little faster, that purpose, my thing that's in front of me that I see, that others see, I'll just be able to grab it. So you hit that button and I'm running, feeling like I could handle it. Even though my body is telling me, chick, I'm going to need you to slow down. You're not ready for this, you know, this speed right now. So just slow it down just a little. I'm ignoring it, thinking, nope, I'm just going to go through. And it was like the faster I made the speed go, just like on a treadmill, the shakier it becomes. You know, there's a certain point on that treadmill when you're running. If you make it go too fast, you hear that dun, 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 dun. It's like making noise and it starts to shake a little bit. And I know for me, a couple of times I almost embarrassed myself at the gym and fell, almost lost my footing because it's shaky and it's going too fast. You know, and I felt like that in life sometimes, like, here I am, Lord, you got it right in front of me. I'm trying to run after it, trying to make my speed, you know, go faster so I can catch it. But man, I done lost my footing and like, you let me slip. You know, why? You know, but then he brought back to my remembrance that David had already answered the question before I had even asked. See, Psalms 37, verse 23, the New King James Version says, the Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. He makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. So in order for me to get on that path and be sure in my strides and not be shaky, I realized I had to go back to the way I used to be and to actually delight myself in being in God's presence, you know, delight myself in him. So I'm like, okay, God, you know, this is good. We having some good dialogue. It's just me and you in the house. Kids are at school. Corey's working. Man, nobody would believe this. We dialoguing. Okay. So I only have one more question for you. I mean, then I had to say, okay, Lord, since you know my thoughts for right now, anyway, of course I'm gonna have more questions for you, but one that's at the top of my mind right now. So I was honestly kind of a little bit scared to ask this one because, you know, sometimes we'll ask God about things and we know that God can say yes, no, or sometimes you just don't hear anything. But then there's certain questions that you have that you hold close to your heart that you may not even discuss with friends, people close to you. And you sometimes don't even ask God because you're so afraid to hear something that could actually break you. Like if you get what you feel is the wrong answer, it could break your heart. And that's how I was feeling. I'm like, Lord, I have this one last question, but I feel like if I ask you and either you don't answer or say no, you know, it might break my heart. But I was like, you know what, Lord, I'm just going to ask you, you know, I've got to face life. Sometimes you don't want to actually face the consequences. You'll acknowledge you made a mistake, but you may not want to actually face what could be a consequence. So I was like, you know what? I can do this. I'm going to face it head on. So Lord, I need to ask you, you know, all these years that I've been home, I've been staying at home for 5 years since 2011 when I lost my job. All these years. And then even some years prior to that, you know, years when I had this burning passion to use my voice to inspire greatness in others through encouragement, just by talking to them and, you know, encouragement. You know, I asked God if he remembered that I had asked him a while back. You know, I asked him to use my voice to become a pen to my generation. You know, I wanted to be an instrument that God would use, you know, to help write the vision for my generation and make it plain, so that when people read it, we could then run with the vision and carry out, you know, what God had for us. So I'm like, God, you remember? Hello, you remember I asked you that, God? You know, I wanted you to use my voice to help break the chains of hopelessness and helplessness and despair off my fellow brothers and sisters. But yet some days, you know, I felt like I had run out of ink and the well had run dry. You know, I asked God, God, let me be your vocal piece. You know, let me be your microphone. Let what you tell me, let me stand up and on the waves of fearlessness and carry your message of hope and faith, you know, to other people. You know, let me be able to do that, Lord. Let me be able to encourage and inspire people through your word fearlessly and not fearful of what people were saying. And it's funny because as I'm saying I want to be fearless, out of nowhere, I felt like fear had decided to boldly just come sit next to me and not even say anything. That's the thing. Just kind of taught me with its presence. Like, yeah, I'm here. Now you're going to do what you say you want to do. And I can't even, I'm trying to articulate it, but have you ever been at a place where you were sure what you wanted to do? Ask God, Lord, please allow me to do this for you, for the advancement of the kingdom. And then all of a sudden it was like a paralyzing fear. Like again, like fear had walked in and just boldly sat down next to you like, go ahead and try it. I dare you. You know, so I was like, okay, God, I don't even know if I can really do this. You know, I had felt like I had fear in one ear trying to remind me that, you know what? If you go ahead and release the unique sound that you believe God gave you for other people, on other people's behalf, those same people might not even understand. They may not even get it. And quite honestly, they just may not be interested. And some who, just for sport sometimes, may even come for my neck to try to discredit and try to, you know, do away with everything I was saying, you know, try to assassinate your character and try to straight up just take your neck off, just behead you because you're bold enough to speak about God's word. The new you is bold enough to speak about God's word. But see, they take the bullets of the old you, hoping to kill that new you, to kill the voice that you've become fearless in using. And all those thoughts are running through my mind. I'm like, okay, God, I don't know if I can do this. You know, like I said, somebody may try to use the old me to assassinate the new me. And for what? Yeah, I want to help other people, but do I want to get myself, you know, killed in the process? So I'm like, you know, wouldn't I just rather stay silent and safe? Just be quiet and just pray for people. You don't necessarily got to speak on a platform or at all. You can just pray in your house. God answers the prayer. So just go ahead and pray. And I'm wondering, should I stay silent? But at the same time, I can't help but feel like a pull, like, Taria, this is something that you have to do. Waking up in the middle of the night with these thoughts and these ideas all geared towards speaking and encouraging people. I mean, clearly, because I'm doing this podcast and this has been on my mind for, you know, years. So I'm waking up with this pull, and I still felt like I felt the embers of the passion I had for just wanting to encourage people through words burning in my belly. But at the same time, again, still questioning, well, you know, I've wanted to do this for years, Lord. So what is it about me doing it now that will really help anybody? How will me going ahead and doing it now at this time, how is that going to be any difference from years prior when I tried to do it? What is it about my now plan, you know, my right now, that's different from my past plans? The plans look the same. It's just a different time. So what's going to be different? What's going to make it really happen? You know what I mean? How will it be different from years prior? How is it really going to come together? You know, some say it's better to be safe than sorry. And, you know, I'm starting to think, well, at that moment, I was starting to think, you know what, maybe it's also better to be silent than stoned. So I'll just be silent. But then, like I said, I just kept feeling like, Taria, you just got to go ahead and do this. And the Lord brought back to my remembrance that he had already sent an answer to me through Queen Esther's story long before I had even asked it. So there's a book in the Bible named Esther, and I'm just going to give you a brief recap of what that book was about. But I encourage anyone who's listening to go and read it, because it's a beautiful, to me, it tells a beautiful story of hope bravery, just, you know, it shows examples of really following God's word and really listening and really going through a process, going through this process when you don't even know how the process could end up. Like, you're going through this process along with a whole lot of other people, knowing that in the end, you may not be the one that God chooses to carry this plan out. So basically, a death warrant had been put out on the Jews. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, the young, the old, women, and children. Didn't matter. But not only to annihilate them on one single day and then take everything they had, take all of their stuff. So there was actually a copy made of this edict, and it was going to be made law and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. So can you imagine, I mean, how much hate had to be put into this plan? Like, not only are we going to annihilate you, kill all the women, the children, the men, take your stuff. Before we do it, we're going to go ahead and put this out there and make it known to everybody so that y'all are aware and ready for when this day comes. I'm like, man. So when I was reading the story, it became very clear that they were serious. They was taking all the Jews out. None were going to be left behind. Now, there was a man in the story named Mordecai. And he was the uncle of Queen Esther. He was a Jew, as was Queen Esther. But the king didn't know Queen Esther was a Jew. You know, her uncle did, but no one else knew she was a Jew. So when her uncle Mordecai heard about the law to assassinate the Jews, he put on what the Bible says is sackcloth and ashes. There goes those. Here come the ashes come up again, y'all. He puts on a sackcloth and ashes, and he just begins to wail. Because can you imagine somebody telling you, listen, we put a hit out on your entire nationality. We want all of y'all gone. You know, and they're giving you, it's not even like it just, you're walking, boom, and then an assassination takes place. They're bold enough to let you know up front, we're getting ready to take all of y'all out, and there's nothing that you can do about it. So he begins, you know, to wail. He's upset. You know, he's like, what's going on? So word gets back to Esther, you know, about the state that her uncle's in and how upset he is. So she sends clothes to him so he can put them on so that he can come and see her, but he refuses. But Esther, you know, that's her uncle. This uncle took her in and raised her as his own. So she then sends one of the king's eunuchs to see, you know, what's troubling him, what has him so upset. So Mordecai tells the eunuch everything that happened to him, including what he heard the amount of money was that had been promised to be paid into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. So they were going to put money in a royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. So he then gave the king's eunuch a copy of the text, you know, of the edict for the annihilation of the Jews to show to Esther and explain it to her. And then he says something very interesting. He told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people, you know, to spare her people, the Jews. Now, remember, the king didn't know she was a Jew. And when I read that, I noticed that he didn't tell the king's eunuch to ask her to go before the king on the Jews' behalf. He tells him, go and instruct her to go before the king. So now when all this was, of course, reported back to Queen Esther, I thought her answer was pretty interesting, honestly. She tells the eunuch, okay, go back and tell my uncle, basically, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. Then she goes on to say, and the king has not called for her in 30 days. So the reason I thought her answer was interesting is because she clearly probably loved her uncle and wanted to remain respectful to him. Again, he, you know, took her in and raised her as his own. So she didn't maybe really want to give a flat out no, or even say, you know, I can be killed, you know, just for going and standing in front of him without him calling me, without him sending for me. So how are you going to ask me to do something like that? This is what I'm thinking. You know, she's probably thinking in her mind, like, how can he even ask me to do something like that? You know, I know I can only imagine if I was in her shoes, I know I would be thinking, you know, even if it was just a split second thought, let's be honest, I have my uncle asking me to do something that could potentially take me out on behalf of other people. I would probably be thinking, I mean, really? So you want me to pretty much seal my own fate of death? You want me to put myself on the line for other people? Like, literally, my life? Like, you took me through a whole process to meet the king, to become queen, and now that I am, you want me to risk it all and my life? Like, I love people and everything. Want to help people, want to encourage people, yes, but really, Jesus? Like, really wants me to put my life on the line, you know, and I'm willing to sacrifice my time, my space, and even money for the cause, for real, but for my life. But, you know, so when Esther's real response, not to Reed's, you know, thinking response, but when Esther's real response to Mordecai's instruction to go before the king, when it gets back to him, he says something that just really got my attention and brought the question that I had asked God originally. He brought that full circle. See, now remember, I said earlier that I wanted God to use me as his pen, as his vocal piece. I wanted God to use me as his microphone to carry out, you know, his message, you know, of encouragement and to inspire people. But that fear reminded me that if I spoke up for people and spoke God's word in truth, you know, in spirit and in truth, you know, spoke about hope and faith and encouraging other people, some people, again, wouldn't like it. Some may not listen. And some may just straight come for my neck to silence me. So I'm thinking Queen Esther was probably feeling the same way, maybe even having the same thoughts. Except she was facing a law that basically said, go ahead and appear before the king on your own if you want to, and you're going to die. She was facing a law that mandated that. But the only way to possibly save her people was to get in front of the king. A king who, like she said, he hadn't even requested to see her in 30 days. So, again, Mordecai's response to Esther really struck something in me. Mordecai says to her, sends word back to her. I'm sorry, Mordecai sends word back through the eunuch to her and says, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And I learned that I'm not the only one that feels that way at times, that sometimes you want to quit and not carry out the assignment that God has given you because sometimes the burden seems like it's just too heavy. And sometimes the burden just seems unfair. And I understood that it's okay that I feel that way as long as I don't stay stuck. It's okay that I have that question. Are you there, God? It's me. As long as I don't stay stuck in that question. I mean, even this generation of powerful leaders goes through the same feelings. As evidenced by my interview with my pastor, the Reverend Dr. Jamal Harrison Bryant in episode 5. There's levels to this. Jamal Harrison Bryant, the activist, the pastor, the man. Listen up.
That it ain't Jamal.
But it's him.
All right.
And my last question for you. There were times in your personal life seemed to play out publicly, yes, almost like it was a drive-in movie, and yes, the world deemed themselves Jamal Bryant's personal Siskel and Ebert.
Yes.
Placing judgment. Did you ever at any point just want to walk away from being the activist, walk away from being the preacher, and just be Jamal?
Once a month. I want to quit every 30 days.
Wow.
There is not any 60-day period where entertaining another option, another career path, another route does not come into play. You cannot at this level operate at a high level of visibility and anointing and not fight through depression, anxiety, stress of the Cirque du Soleil balancing act of having the supernatural and having urges that are carnal.
Wow.
So you have a lot of gifted people who are alcoholics, who are drug addicts, who are gamblers. You look at how many police officers are divorced.
Hmm.
You know, how many doctors are out of shape? How many lawyers are on cocaine? That you can't operate at that level and then come back down to normalcy to say, take the trash out.
Okay.
Wow. So there's not a 60-day period that I don't go through.
And seriously consider.
And seriously consider, God, is this you?
Wow.
You know, I can't feign that I can go in any of 50 states of America and it's a line 2 miles down the street to get to where I am and get home and I got to figure out, where are you? So to have to balance that is a different level that you can't process in public.
Okay.
So people see the reverberation but don't know the sound. Mm. So it says, okay, this came from what? Out of what area? I started my church at 28, driving a Maxima, right?
Okay.
And in 3 years, I'm driving a Bentley.
Wow.
So people who say money don't change you are people who've never had it.
Mm,
okay. So when I started this church, I lived 3 blocks from Pimlico Racetrack. Yeah, see, I was living in Park Heights.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I lived right behind Sinai Hospital.
Okay.
So when I'm talking about what Park Heights is, it's not from a data study.
It's what you know.
It's what it is that you know. But I'm also a prodigy that while having to deal with that, I owned my first house at 25 with no loan from my parents. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
So is how do you govern knowing that level of success with having balance and having access? You know what I mean? So by 31, I'm on a stage with Jakes.
Wow. So clearly we can see that when God has created you, when he's created you to lead the masses, when he created you leaving an imprint of leadership on you, and when you have trailblazer woven all through your DNA, it certainly is not going to be a cakewalk. Just because you have the gift doesn't mean it's going to be easy. But he does not leave you out there to fail. He'll continue to help you, continue to restore you. You see, I realize that God has laid out a strategy for my life in his word, the Bible, and he's given me the tools to become strategic in the form of Miss Michelle Thornton, the senior VP at BET. Go on and eavesdrop as her and I discuss what being a strategic means in episode 16, Michelle Thornton, from bad chick to that chick, who is now strategic.
I love that. Okay.
Yes. So now we're going to move on to strategic. And y'all, I'm telling you, I'm going to tell you at the end how to get the book, but you have to get the book. It asked some tough questions. She had me looking at myself like, I got to close this Kindle for a minute and get myself together before I can finish some of those questions. Like, wait a minute. When you're truly, you make people be honest with themselves. And that's what I love about your book. So now in the book, strategic, you give us the official definition for the word strategy, which is defined as a careful plan or method for achieving a particular goal, usually over a long period of time. You also share that other sources state the origination of the word is a military term, hence there's no female connotation to it. So what is it that made you feel that you had to come up with a word that encompasses the meaning of strategy, but yet related specifically to women?
Because women from the beginning of time have been fighting for their lives, fighting for their family. We already at war all the time. You know, when something happens, you know, the first person be like, what? You say that to who?
Right.
So we're fighting for the wrong reason. So I'm saying have a strategy and fight for yourself.
Okay.
Like we're in those times that is necessary. So, and I love to take people off guard. Oh, I'm not a strategist. Oh, strategy is not used for me, for a woman. Okay, well, let's go on and give all women the title of strategic. If she's planning, if she is walking in her purpose,
okay,
if she is following through and building her relationships, let's give her a title and a name and a branding that says, no, you don't. Nobody can tell you that you can't put a plan together. And
wow,
activate it.
I love it.
Activate your superpowers,
yes,
as we like
we
to say.
We are strategic. I love that.
Okay. But for everyone else.
But not for ourselves. Well, see, I think you're a mind reader, because that leads into my next question.
Right.
It's always for everyone else.
For everyone else.
Okay. So now, in your words, strategic is when women carefully design or plan to serve a particular purpose or advantage for their lives. So I was blown away with your definition, because I never looked at my life like I have to design a plan to get to the plan that God has for me. I was always focused on the plan he had for me. So what was there a defining moment in your life that shifted your perspective to focus on creating that strategic plan to get to God's plan so that you could carry out the plan in a way that honors God? Or did you always innately know that you had to physically create a plan to get to the master plan?
So, you know, I've been wanting to write a book. I've been wanting to write a book for a long time, and it's gone through several iterations. And I'll never forget this. I was laying in bed. It was midnight. And I was like, what am I going to write a book on? I was like, you know what, Michelle, you've just been a strategist. Like, you know, things have happened and you're paying attention and you're making moves. I was like, you know what, maybe I should write a book on strategy. I was like, I'm a strategist. You know, and then I thought about it. I was like, what's a female version for strategy? I was like, wait a minute, this could be strategic. Then I Googled it, and then my husband was like, you're crazy. And then I got a credit card, and I went to GoDaddy, and I said, I'm gonna own this word. And then I LLC'd. I did a lot of things, right? My daughter's like, you should actually make that word in the dictionary, but there's a whole lot of things around that.
Okay.
But the whole point was that I had watched my life, and when things didn't go the way that I wanted, when people didn't give me what I had earned, when I even learned to ask, because 80% of women don't ask for what they've earned. They don't even know what it is. They don't have the metrics. And I've done that time and time again. Then I started telling other people to do it. I was like, you know what? Let me put all this in this little book and begin to tell women, you know, we don't actually have to be given what people want to give us. We can actually get what we've earned.
Wow.
And I don't even have to wait for somebody to do that. So I always tell people, I'm not a CEO at this company, but I'm a CEO of my company,
which is your life,
strategic
your family.
Strategic LLC. I'm the president. So I created my own CEO title, and people look at you differently.
Okay.
When you take the initiative, do something. Even people at my job, they're like, I didn't even know you were writing a book. Of course you didn't. Why would I tell you that? Why would I share that with you?
Wow.
Why would I don't need, I'm just going to walk in this. And then all of a sudden, what happened? My little Miss Brittany is sitting here. I was like, Brittany, this book is done. She's like, people are going to be so
blown away. Brittany is the best, y'all, by the way.
Yeah,
just had to shout that out.
My right hand, left hand, prayer warrior.
Wow.
So I just put in the book the conversations I had with women along the way. And look, for real, the men could use this book too. I felt like I wanted to give something to women because we're always serving people. We're in servitude all the time, and we should be serving our best selves, because when we walk in our best selves, then we become or get to a place where we can actually empower others.
Okay.
And we want to do that. We want to uplift other people. So that was the notion. So I just put all that planning, all those things. And when I decided to leave CNN, I really had a master plan. And it's in the book.
Man, y'all, that interview with Michelle was so inspiring to me, especially with me being a woman who's trying to follow God's plan for my life and having to learn, sometimes the hard way, that the way to get there and stay there is by creating a strategy that I need to abide by, that I need to be disciplined to stick to. And she's living proof that it can be done. She is so full of hashtag black girl magic, unicorn magic. And speaking of magical unicorns that share my melanin, this brings me to a bright, shining, encouraging, and guiding star that is a role model to so many women, and some men too. Now, if you hadn't guessed it by now, I'm talking about the dope radio and TV host, ambassador for women, an author, and a voice for the voiceless, Miss Dani Starr. And trust me when I tell you that her entire being matches her last name, Starr. I remember meeting her, and she was just so full of love and light, and just, she had none of that star power, meaning people that have risen so high up that they're now stars, so they're untouchable. She was so touchable. She was so warm, so embracing. It just really, really blew me away. The Dani that you hear on the radio is the Dani that you get in real life. She did not change. And like I said, her whole being matches her last name, Star. But there were times in her life when she didn't feel like she was shining like how she knew she was created to shine. So I want you to get your ear hustle on by listening to this segment from episode 24. In the darkest night, a star shines its brightest. Dani Star gives us a little TLC.
Because you're constantly Switzerland, constantly playing the middle ground.
Yep.
I like that. Okay, so the next, now, so we've gone from your golden hour, which you're in, but you've told us about your twilight, so now let's talk about your dark hour. It's dark. So for 3 months after the birth of your beautiful, she is beautiful, your daughter MJ.
Thank you.
She is so beautiful, and your twin. You said you suffered with undiagnosed postpartum depression.
You know, I honestly was longer than that. It was, so remnants of that still exist.
Okay.
I think that it changes you so much. So yes, I suffered from postpartum depression when I had Munch, and then with baby, I suffered from postpartum anxiety.
Yes.
Okay. Which is like the evil stepsister of postpartum depression. That, without a doubt, over everything else in my entire life, was my darkest hour. I was like a shell of myself. It was almost like watching, like an out-of-body experience.
Watching you try to operate.
While you watch yourself not being yourself, and all you can do is look, but you can't really help yourself. It was awful. I will say that as awful as it was, the experience, you know, I would never be like, oh yes, I'd go through that again. Hell no. That I wouldn't wish that upon an enemy. But I wasn't expecting to grow so much from it. I wasn't expecting to have a level of empathy that I now do. And I wasn't expecting, when something is that dark, it's hard to find light in it.
Okay.
There's been so much light since then. And so for me, it's like, had I not gone through that and everything leading up to that, I don't think I'd be sitting here like today. Like I'm so much more prepared for my life and to live my life and
to know again that there'll be consequences maybe for the way you live your life, but you're emotionally prepared to deal with that.
I am. And now, because you know, mental health is so important to me, it set a fire in me, this is passion to, you know, help with mental health awareness and help mothers and babies and all these things. So it was super dark, right?
Well, can you explain the difference? Because I'll never forget hearing you talk about how you thought maybe you were dealing with postpartum depression, but you kind of knew it kind of wasn't sort of that. And then someone, I don't know if it was a text maybe, but you said someone had told you about the anxiety part of it.
Right. So when I had postpartum depression, we didn't even know what that was. I had no idea what that was. And that was the first time around. And then when I got postpartum anxiety, I kept swearing up and down that, oh, this isn't postpartum depression. I'm off to a good start. You know, this is good.
Okay.
Because I knew that I didn't feel the way I felt the last time.
Okay.
So all I kept thinking is, I'm not sad, and I'm not, you know, I'm functioning, and I'm doing all these things. But I was missing these huge signs of, yeah, but your breathing is constantly, like, really, like, you're not normal right now. You're sweating all the time, and your whole body is doing...
And in certain situations, it would make you like that, right? So
It was pretty constant after I had the baby. So, like, I would think I was being normal. But that was becoming my normal. Like, my normal was constant worry, overreacting. It was just really bad. And so a friend of mine said, we went to lunch, and I remember we just started talking, and I was like, but I'm good because I don't have postpartum depression. And she was like, I think you should see someone. And I remember being like, what? Like, no, I did this before. I know this isn't bad. But, you know, who knew that it had so many different, you know, there are many types of cancers.
Yes.
Right?
And I never knew there were many types of postpartum.
Yeah, like, there's just, like, there's stages to it, and there's... No, there's many types. Why can't there be stages? If everything else has stages, why would you only think you could have the most severe thing ever? And that's how I felt. So I was really blessed. Nadia, that's my friend's name. I call her my postpartum sponsor. And she still to this day checks in on me weekly. She sends me cards. She's amazing. She's a huge part of my life. And I'm so thankful for her because she's the one who's like, no, we're going to make sure you make sure you're okay.
That you're okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And that speaks to you surrounding yourself again with people who
you have to,
who not only notice a difference in you, but are willing to speak up at the risk of whatever and say, no, but you're not good.
Yep.
Wow. So what could the family of either an expecting mother or one that just had a baby, what are different things that they maybe could do to prepare in case that happens, or what signs should they look for within the mother as far as the anxiety and the postpartum?
I think you just need to pay attention. I was not normal.
Okay.
And I think people are like, oh, she just had a baby, so, you know, hormones, emotions. But if you know your person,
okay,
if you know your partner, if you know your best friend,
okay,
and your best friend calls you every day and you guys laugh all the time, and all of a sudden you're not laughing with her at all, and you're losing touch with her. You know your people.
Okay.
If your people start acting differently,
you know.
You need to ask some questions. You need to follow up, and you need to not believe them all the time when they say, "Oh, I'm fine."
Okay.
How often have you told someone you're fine when you know you're not?
Lots of times.
Now, when you're struggling with something like mental health, you will definitely try to hide it because it's, you know, again, because of the stigma. So. I would just say really pay attention and educate yourself if you have questions, and talk to your person. Are you doing okay? Is there anything I can do to help you? Because this is a lot. Your body went through a lot. Your life just went through a lot. So I
don't think people get it's like chemical.
Oh my gosh, pay attention. Yeah, because it could save a life for real.
That's good stuff. I'm glad. Okay. So now when you were going through this, you were married. What advice would you give a husband, independent of the friends and the family, on how to support a wife that, or not even a husband, a partner.
Well, at the end of the day, you're on the front lines.
Okay.
Nobody else is seeing what you're seeing.
You're there.
You're there constantly. So I would say, pay attention, but you have an extra duty to protect your person.
Because
One, you signed up for that. You know what I mean? You signed up to be with this person forever. This is your partner. This is the person who just brought a life in that also belongs to you.
Mm.
Pay attention, you know, and believe her.
Okay, just because you don't physically see
it. Yeah, it's hard for people to understand mental health because it's easy to see when someone, you know, when somebody breaks an arm. Okay. Like, oh, you broke your arm, that must hurt. You know,
gotcha.
Oh, your leg is broken, that sucks. But you can't see mental health issues like that. You know, you can't see the turmoil that a person is going through. So you just think, oh, it can't be that bad. It might even be worse.
It might even be worse than what you can see. Okay. So now, I know you did a documentary called The Dark Side of the Moon. So where can we find it so that people can watch? Because I know when I saw the ads coming out for it, just not even having seen it yet, but just, I don't know, I felt something.
Yeah.
You know.
So Dark Side of the Full Moon is out now. It played at a bunch of different film festivals, but you can get it on iTunes. I'm pretty sure if you could, it's like darksideofthefullmoon.com. I'm pretty sure you can get it from there. But if you care about women and you care about babies, I think it's a really great documentary to watch in general because it is eye-opening about the experience that women go through. You know, not all women, but some women. But it's very eye-opening, and it will change your perspective on a lot of things. And not even just because I'm in it, but I would have loved to have seen something like that prior.
Okay, so then you would kind of know maybe.
It was helpful, you know? It's helpful to see that, to even know.
Guys, I'm telling you, she's amazing. And make sure you go and buy her book on Amazon titled Empathy and Eyebrows. I myself have 2 copies. I ordered it on Amazon, and then I went to her book signing in Baltimore, which if you can go to her Instagram and look at her schedule, if she's going to be in a city near you, I encourage you to go. It was beautiful to see how the women just connected with her and how she connected with the women. So again, the book is on Amazon. You can buy it in paperback form, or you can download it and listen. It's titled Empathy and Eyebrows, and I promise you, you will laugh, cry, be happy, get sad, and then celebrate with her. And if you're lucky, you'll get your eyebrows on point through the process. Guys, thank you so much for tuning into this episode, number 45, Empowering Episodes from Empowered People, Part 1. And remember, this is only part 1 of the empowering episodes. I have more parts to come with more empowered people. Now, if you like the episode snippets, You can go back and listen to the full episodes on Blueberry, BLUBRRY, iTunes, iTunes, Stitcher, StitcheR, Google Play Music, Podbean, and any place podcasts are hosted. And all you have to do is type in Tales from a Butterfly. Also, head on over to TariaShondell.com. That's T as in Tom, AriaShondell.com to follow my blog by the same name, Tales from a Butterfly. And FYI, if you guys don't have iTunes, as I mentioned earlier, you can listen in on Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com. Now, when the Tales from a Butterfly directory pops up, click on the episode you want to listen to, and you will be given options to subscribe to the podcast. And please share the episodes with your friends, family, coworkers, and even your enemies. Hey, it just might convert them and make them friends. And speaking of social media, you can follow me on Twitter at TS Faison, Instagram at TS Faison, and on Facebook, Tales from a Butterfly. And guys, remember, no matter what situation you go through this week, no matter what situations you may find yourself in, you will come out of it okay, because your current caterpillar will one day become your future butterfly. Fly on, butterflies. Love you guys, and thanks for listening.